Hello, young lovers, whoever you are, I hope your troubles are few. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love like you. You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star. Brave and faithful and true. And cling very close to each other tonight. I've been in love like you. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You fly down that street on the...
I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and you are listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. And each night, we'll bring you the best and the brightest authors and experts with solutions, the topics you want to hear, and the people who know to bring them to you. So let's do it. Let's do it together. Let's get to the heart of the issues it faces every day, right here, right now on Dresser After Dark, coast to coast, and around the world on the BBS Radio Network.
You wing down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet, not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say, don't cry because I'm alone. All of my memories are happy tonight.
Dr. Karen Sherman with us. She's the author of Mindfulness and the Art of Choice. That's the second edition. Transform Your Life. She's a psychologist in private practice. Her specialty is relationships and helping people reach their highest potential. She's also co-authored Marriage Magic, Find It, Keep It, and Make It Last, and was a contributor to 101 Great Ways to Improve Your Life, Volume 2. And additionally, Karen is featured as featured writer on Yahoo Personals, has a column on HitchToMag.com, and is a blogger on ThirdEdge.com. And let us say, Karen, hi, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Michael. It's so good to be with you.
Oh, and thank you for being... Did I say that right? HitchToMagic.
HitchMag.com.
HitchMag. Okay. We were close, but I will never get it wrong again. It's HitchMag.com. Karen, when we talk about this word and we hear it thrown around and bantered around so many times, and it's a word that is so elusive and most people have no idea how to reach it, and that word is mindfulness. And in all of your experience, where was it for you that you realized the power in that word?
Well, it came after an experience where I had really gotten to a bad point in my life. I hit rock bottom. And after that experience, it occurred to me that for most of my life, I had been living unmindfully, sort of on autopilot. And I realized that if I was going to really get the most out of life, I had to live in the present, be here now, enjoy what was around me, and really become aware of what was, you know, in my day-to-day living.
So in essence, you were living 2 hours ahead and 2 years behind and not in the present.
Yeah, very much so, Michael. Nicely put.
By the way, you've described probably 80% of the audience.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And that's part of the reason that I do the work that I do, because I believe that people have the right to have the lives that they want, to be able to transform and stop being prisoners to their past.
Now, by the way, when we're prisoners of our past, and do we actually know we're prisoners? That, you know, the practical reason that you talk about old behaviors are a problem. Do we even realize that we are operating out of old behaviors, creating the patterns that we have in our life, creating the outcome in our life? Is most of this unconscious? You and I get into a little brief argument, and you've got that look on your face, and that look on your face was something that I saw 20 years ago on somebody else, and now I'm not arguing with you. I'm arguing with her, and the problems start.
Oh, boy, have you got it right on the nose. Absolutely. We don't realize it at all. We're on autopilot. We are emotionally frozen. And what happens is that right now when I see that look on your face, I react, and I think I'm really reacting to that look on your face, having no idea that I got triggered from something that happened 20 years ago.
Now, how do you bring that out in a person? When I say how do you bring that out, you're a professional. You do it constantly, day in, day out, and it's second nature to you. You're trained with it. You've gone through it, been there, done that, and you understand it. But the average person, they're living like this, and they're not realizing that they do have choice. They do have options in their life. They're trying to be the best they can be based on somebody else's definition of what the best is, and they're not living a fully satisfying life.
Well, what you have to basically do is start to be aware. You can't make change unless you're aware. And you've got to look at your life and see if it is really working for you, so to speak. You know, are you having the same relationship over and over and over again, even though it's people dressed in different clothes, so to speak?
Yeah.
You know, are you finding that you are never feeling good in different situations? You know, it can't always be the different situations. You know, so you have to look for patterns. Are you always feeling lousy? So those are the kinds of things that let you know that your life is not working well for you.
I would venture to guess if you sat most people down and you would say to them, people who are in a relationship and or are married or just recently broke up with somebody, it's everybody basically. But if you would say to them, describe your mother emotionally, not physically, mm-hmm. emotionally. Describe mm-hmm. your father emotionally, not physically.
Mm-hmm.
And then describe your husband, your wife, mm-hmm. your significant other, your whatever. You're going to find one of them in there. And mm-hmm. realistically, that relationship is based on what you didn't complete with.
100%. 100%. Yeah. What we do is, without knowing it at a sub-awareness level, we actually are drawn to people who have those qualities because in our relationships, we're looking to heal what we didn't finish off in our childhood. So as you can well imagine, Michael, that really ends up creating a problem in our relationships because those old issues come back up in to resurface in the relationship and creates quite a lot of havoc.
Well, sure. It's either mom, it's either dad. And then again, too, it's back to mindful and the art of the choice. And realistically,
right.
if I don't know any better, it's not what I don't know, it's what I don't know that I don't know. And
that's
because
correct.
Of that, if I don't know that, I don't have the choices that are available to me.
Well, yes, because what's happening is you're reacting emotionally. It's almost like I call it a personal tsunami. And people will tell me often that they feel as if they were possessed, that this reaction comes over them, and they couldn't help themselves. And that's accurate. Before they realize, before they become educated about this, it really is that they have no choice. So their emotions take over, and they can't think about what they're doing. Emotions will always win out, so to speak, over clear thinking.
No question about it. And I think at base, no matter what we do, we're looking to become emotionally satisfied at base. Whatever the decision that we're going to make is, at the end result of that will give us some emotional satisfaction. That's what's going to cause us to create that choice. But if you're proving yourself right about yourself, if you're proving that you're a loser, if you're proving that you can't make it and you're not worth it and so on and so forth, there is some, as bad as this sounds, there is some satisfaction in that. So you realistically got to find out what success means, because failure can be success in many cases, and there's no way to turn it around unless you've got yourself honed in on it and targeted.
Well, yes, you're absolutely right about that, but here's the other part of it. What if it does work in that moment, but it's only short-lived?
Sure.
So then what happens is you have to keep doing it over and over and over again. I mean, I'm from New York, so look at what was just going on with Anthony Weiner. I'm sure that in the short run, he was very satisfied. And then he kept doing it over and over and over again. And,
absolutely.
You know, we know the outcome of what happened there.
Yeah, no question about it. And I really believe, when it really comes down to it, that the world out there, it's nothing more, Karen, than a big mirror. And I used this example a couple, 3 months ago on the air, and I think it's time again, which was, I can't remember exactly what the words were. I'm trying to hide it, but I just can't remember what the words were. Let's call it loser, and let's call it dependent. All right. My sister and I rarely will get into an argument, but we got into an argument, and I looked at her and I said, "You loser." And she says, "You're nothing more than somebody who's dependent." And I walked out of the room and I said, "Who? Wait a minute. That's me that I called her." And I walked back into the room, and what I called her is what I thought I was. What she called me is what she thought she was. And most people don't get that.
Yes. Yes. Well, we often put on to other people what it is either that we're feeling about ourselves or what we want. And so what happens is that we're never really conscious or mindful of who the other person is. It's all about us. We're still caught up in our own emotions, right?
Sure. You know, no question about it. And it's Well, I've learned this over many, many, many years now. I don't want to tell you how many years, but many, many, many years now. And basically,
but you see, that's the advantage, Michael, of our years. We have learning under our belts.
Well, wait, but that's the key. Why should somebody, and here we go, Karen, why should somebody go through all of the trauma, all the stress, all of those getting knocked down, getting back up again, if they could learn mindfulness and the art of choice ahead of time? You see, I can learn in an hour what it took you all of your life to learn because you put it to pen. And I think that's really why when a writer writes, and especially if it's in this venue, and if you really get into it and take advantage of it, you don't have to go through all of those things. You can anticipate it. You can be aware of it before it even happens.
Well, that's certainly part of the reason that I wrote the book, because I want people to know that they don't have to have a life that is unhappy, that they don't have to keep repeating patterns from their past, that they can make differences in their lives. So you're 100% right. You know, the other thing, Michael, that I'd like to share is that I look for three signals. You know, you said before, as a professional, I know what to look for, but I'm going to share them with your audience, because if they see themselves doing this, then that's a way that they can tell if they're doing a reaction from their past. Number one, if they react really, really quickly to a situation, like happens in a nanosecond. Number two, if their reaction is way too intense from what the situation is. Or for what the situation is, excuse me. And number three, if when the person then says, I'm sorry, or it was a miscommunication, or whatever it is, they can't let it go. They just keep coming back to it. They keep harping on it. And you know why? Because it wasn't about what just happened. It's still about something from their past.
Sure, so, and they don't really have control over it.
I'm sorry.
They don't really have control over it.
That's exactly right.
And then one of two things happen. You and I walk into the room. We see each other. One of two things are going to happen with me and or you. You're going to get a shot of adrenaline or a shot of dopamine. The adrenaline is going to cause you to defend yourself out against me, and you're not even consciously thinking about it. And that's all the three things that you just said. The dopamine makes me feel good and enjoy being with you.
Mm-hmm. But and you know, either one is going to blindside you, right?
Pardon?
Isn't either one of them going to blindside you?
Oh, absolutely. If you don't understand if you don't know what goes on, there's an entire dynamic that occurs when you see something, that something creates an image. The image ties right back to whatever the experience was. And there you go.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. But most people don't realize that.
No.
So that's why I'm saying you're not living in the present. You're not, you know, like you started to say, a lot of us get nervous about what's going to happen in the future, but most of all what happens is you're living in the past without even realizing it.
Somebody once said something to me, and I will always remember that, and it was said to me probably maybe 30, 35 years ago now. What was said was, you know, life is like this. You're driving down the street, on the highway of life, and you got your hands on the rear view mirror, and you're staring with the rear view mirror, and you get into a lot of accidents. But if you just make a simple shift in your life and get your hands down on the steering wheel, things look completely different.
That's fabulous. I love it.
Yeah, I remember that forever, and that's what most of us do. It's not who you are, it's who you were, and that's already gone.
Yeah. Now, the other thing that I want to point out is, you know, you and I are talking and we're explaining, and you and I are obviously totally on the same wavelength about understanding where this comes from.
Yeah.
And as we're explaining this to the audience, I'm hoping that they're understanding it as well. And that's what you get when you go to talk therapy. You understand these issues. But I think that I know that the exercises that I'm offering in the book is different than talk therapy, because you know how we're saying that you have this immediate reaction. That reaction is coming from the stored up energy in your body, from the things that got wired in whenever the initial insult was, so to speak. And so if that's not released, even though you understand what has happened, when you still see that look on somebody's face, or you hear loser or whatever else, you're still going to have that reaction.
Now, let me ask you something real quick.
What has to happen?
Yeah, but let me hold you. This is important. Let me hold you up. The There's a little bit of a delay, but this is critically important. Do you do workshops?
Yes, I do.
Okay, but let's go to one of the workshops that maybe happened within the last month or so.
Okay.
And let's talk about somebody who was in that workshop, who had the problems we're talking about. What kind of a technique did they use to be able to move themselves to see the way life can be for them?
Okay. What I do, the majority of the work that I do is with visualizations, because the brain cannot tell the difference between reality and visualizations. And so I work with helping people feel the sensation, because there's always a bodily sensation that goes with the emotional upset. People don't realize that, but there's always a bodily sensation that goes with the emotional upset. And so I help people locate the bodily sensation and then float it back to whatever the original upset was, and then visualize it and get to express whatever it was that never got expressed initially.
Okay, let me see if I can paraphrase this. And I'm not a clinician, so you have to help me here. Okay, so Sam came into the workshop, and Sam was having problems, and he doesn't know what the problems were. But we know that the problems were coming from the past. Sam began to realize that the unconscious mind dealt in the language of pictures and symbols, pictures and images here. Mm-hmm. And he began to realize that, and as he realized that, when he got into it and he began to feel a sensation that was going on, when his issue started to come up, he began to tie into it. And when he could visualize the sensation, he began to see what the reality of it was, which allowed him to move through it. Is that about it?
Pretty much. But then what happens is, let me talk about specifically what happened.
Yeah.
I'll tell you the end result and then tell you what happens. So at the end of the workshop, this woman, who I would say was probably in her 70s, comes up, because I walked them through this exercise, and says to me that when she was 7 years old, her cousin touched her inappropriately, and she had never told anybody about it, but for her entire life, she has been angry about this and felt used. And that after we did this exercise, she was able to let go of this anger. Now, here's what basically happened. I told them to think about something that recently happened that got them upset, because we started with something recent. And then I said, feel it in your body. And now take that same sensation and float it back to wherever it takes you. Don't think it. Just feel the sensation and allow it to float back. And wherever it takes you, now imagine yourself at that age, because that's where the original insult or injury or trauma is. And imagine yourself at that age expressing what you never had a chance to express, because that's the trapped energy. And you're going to express it to your adult self as you are now, because your adult self is basically being the unconditionally loving parent. And you're releasing this energy, but it's while these feelings are actually being activated. And then you end the visualization where you end it whatever way is satisfying to the small self. It does not have to be historically correct.
Sure.
And so by interrupting this old connection that the brain has made, in the, let's say, this woman's case, now I'm hypothesizing as to what happened.
Sure. Sure.
Where the cousin touched her and she felt awful and ashamed or angry or whatever. Maybe she ended it that the cousin apologized to her. Or maybe she ended it that she slapped the cousin and said, don't do that to me. Whatever it was.
Yeah.
But it was a different connection. She no longer felt victimized. She was able to let go of it.
Okay, we're running out of time, but let me tell you what just happened. The process that you're talking about is through imagery, visualization.
Yes.
And we just created imagery and visualization to make it understandable to everybody in the audience. Same, same.
Yes.
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 And with that, we're starting to run out of time. Do you have a website we can find you at?
Yes. DrKarenSherman.com. DrKarenSherman.
Wonderful. Hey, Karen Sherman, thank you so much for joining us. Can we buy the book there?
Yes, absolutely, or any of the online sites. And I would encourage people to do so, because they can have a life of choice.
dynamite. Hey, Karen, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Michael, for the opportunity. Bye-bye.
Take care. Good night.
So many exciting and wonderful places, mountains and jungles and desert oases. Pleasant as home is, it isn't what Rome is, so why stay there? When there are so many fabulous faraway places to see. Why should Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me? I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London. Wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see. There are so many simply incredible places to see. When I think of the warm Caribbean.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Barry LaPatner is with us. He's the founder of the New York City-based law firm, LaPatner & Associates, LLP. He's the author of Broken Buildings, Busted Budgets, How to Fix America's Trillion-Dollar Construction Industry. And for three decades now, he's been prominent as an advisor on business and legal issues affecting the real estate, design, and the construction industries. He's recognized as one of the nation's leading advisors to corporate and institutional clients, real estate owners, and design professionals. He's also been awarded the distinction of Super Lawyer by Super Lawyer Magazine. That was in 2009. And he's rated as one of the top 10 real estate attorneys in New York City by the New York Observer. Let's say very hi. Welcome to the show.
Good to join you tonight.
Oh, and thank you so much for joining us. By the way, Barry, did I pronounce your last name correctly?
Barry LaPatner, very simple.
Got it. Okay, loud and clear. We're on the same page. Barry, for years now, people have been trying to save money, and they get somebody to do some construction design, some something that, and the people aren't licensed. They don't have the contractor's license and so on and so forth. And they'll come into a situation and somebody will give them a quote of pick a number of $50,000. And by the time they're done, it could cost them $150,000. And they can't really say no because they're right in the middle of the project. Is this basically what caused you to take a look at this issue?
Well, what most Americans don't understand, most corporations don't understand, is that the construction business at every level of our society, whether we're building additions onto our houses or we're building mega projects like airports or tall buildings, is done by mom-and-pop companies. There are no General Motors, Dell Corporation, Apples, who are doing the building of hundreds of millions of dollars of projects and billions of dollars of projects. So we're dealing largely with panel trucks who pull up to a project, who are putting in glass, who are putting in brick, who are putting in stone. And therefore, we're dealing with small businesses who don't assume risk and don't have deep pockets. And the public has to understand when they sign a contract for $50,000, $30,000, or $150,000, that they're taking a risk unless they do the proper due diligence that has to be done with whom they're doing business.
And by the way, Barry, stop me if I'm wrong with this. I owned a construction company probably 30 years ago now. Now, I was not in the construction business, and I did not have a license. But I had a supervisor who had, I think it was a B1 license, if I'm not mistaken, at the time. One of the things that I did learn through that process was this. Let's say that I want something done and you come in as a contractor, but you're not licensed and something goes wrong. Well, I can't really sue you, but if you have a license, then I can sue you for the contractual liability that you had me under in the first place. Am I close here? Because I think that's the way it worked that many years ago.
with a license or without a license, if there's nothing behind your shell company and you formed Jones Construction and you've got $11 in the bank because every week you're always short on money and you take it out to pay your own phone bills or to pay your employees, there's nothing there that provides security for the homeowner or the corporation.
Okay, but the point of contention is if there is dollars there, and by the way, in those days, everything was fine because it was mom and pop, and everybody in town knew where I lived, so I had to be good. But when it really comes down to it, if they do have money, if I don't have a license, can you sue me?
There are various state laws, there are various city laws, which say in order to do home improvement work, you have to have a license. If you don't, the contract is void, or somebody within X period of time, upon asking a question, do you have the license, finding out you don't, they can cancel the contracts. But if someone is on a project today and for a lot of reasons decides to walk off or to not come back or to only send one worker when 10 should be there as they promised, there is very little recourse for the homeowner or the corporation to sue, because most contractors in America do not have deep pockets.
Okay, now what about, and we've heard, especially with what's been going on the last couple of months, unions, powerful, non-powerful, but if you bring somebody in from a union, is there going to be any protection there?
The union worker, the worker who is employed by the union, is hired by a contractor from a union hall. The union worker will tell you they work for the union, not for the person, the company who hired them. So what you have to understand is that union pay and union workers are working on projects where, for whatever reason, unions are required to be hired on those projects. Around the nation, most projects are non-union. In large cities, you see unions have a strength and they are hired for city work, governmental work, and the like. But the difference between a union worker and a non-union worker, insofar as the company they're employed for, doesn't make a difference to the company who hires them. There's going to be a price difference, sometimes as much as 20 or 30%. But in terms of the company, whether it's a sheetrock company, an electrician, a plumber, whether that company is hiring union or non-union, your recourse, if they don't perform as the owner of a project, is not against the union. It's against the company who hired them.
And there's no contingent liability.
There's no liability. If there's nothing there, after the end of the day, you can win a judgment for $50,000 or $1 million. If there's no assets there, if the only thing they have is another job, you're not going to be recovering much money, and you're going to have a project that's delayed, and you're going to have a project that's going to cost you a lot more to replace that defaulting subcontractor.
Okay, so effectively, the contractor in and of themselves, when they bring somebody from the union in, they're not dealing with the union directly. They're dealing with those individuals that happen to belong to the union.
That's correct.
Okay, so the union has no liability here. Okay, the other thing, too, is I know it's critical, and most people wouldn't know how to do this, to do due diligence, to vet those people, to get a background check on them. What's the first step to do that?
Well, there's two levels here. Of course, corporations who have a lot at stake to make sure they hire the right team members should be doing a high level of due diligence, checking out not only the company itself, but the people who are behind the company, their past projects, any criminal records and the like. But for the average homeowner, the due diligence you can do is a couple of simple things. Number one, have the contractor or the subcontractors take you to prior projects, spend the time, look at the quality of the work, see if you like it, if you feel good about it, and say, this could be done in my home. Ask the owners, not some worker who's standing there on another project. Ask the homeowner, how has the work of this subcontractor been? Have they lived up to warranties? Did they do work? Were they prompt? Did they show up when they were supposed to? There's a whole series of these questions that are worth the while before you hire every subcontractor and every contractor on the job to spend the time asking questions, especially if it relates to plumbing, electricity, putting in air conditioning systems and ducts and heating systems and ductwork, and for the finishes on the project. Don't hire a painter because they told you that they worked for Tiffany's or they did this fabulous job in the local school. You have to understand that unless you go and see the work and ask the owner, was it Mr. Smith who did the job for you? Did he show up on time and ask all those questions? That's the due diligence that if you don't ask, you can end up regretting that you didn't spend the time up front.
No, I think one thing is very important here. It's in your talking points where I think it's critical that most people have no concept. You come into my home and I'm going to hire you to do whatever it is for construction. And what you're saying here, and I hadn't thought about this before, thoroughly, carefully, the tailored contracts, owners should be given the right to approve all subcontracts for their projects. Barry, most people, I am quite confident, wouldn't even think of it. They bring somebody in. This is the do-all, be-all, end-all, the go-to guy. They're going to take care of you. And who thinks about vetting the subcontractors? I think it's a brilliant point.
Well, we walk around wherever we live, and we see a large construction project. And very often, there's a sign, and it says, Jones Construction Manager. And we all like to believe that since this is a $50 million, $150 million, or a $400 million project, that Jones Construction Managers must be a huge operation that can stand behind everything. The reality of it is the construction manager may have 4, 5, 6 people assigned to the project, and there's 20, 30, or 40 subcontractors, another 20 or 30 suppliers who are showing up every day in a panel truck. That's their sole asset. And when you understand that the work is being done by mom-and-pop folks, just like your local butcher and your local baker, then you realize for the amount of money we're investing, we ought to do our due diligence. Would you buy a used car from someone who you didn't know, who pulled up in a panel truck and said, I have a car for you? You say, that would be ridiculous. I go to a local dealer. He's been there for 20 years. He sold my father a car. It was great. He sold my uncle a car, my aunt. We know what that due diligence is. If we're going to invest money in our house, which is our largest personal asset, we should do a little homework and spend the time inquiring who's doing the work.
No question. Barry, we're starting to run out of time. Do you have a website we can find you at and get more information?
Sure. www.lepatner.com. LePatner.com. You'll find some wonderful, interesting articles on there. You'll find out articles about contractors who are reputable, contractors who are not reputable, some wonderful projects we report on, and also things about our national infrastructure, which I've written widely about and spoken widely around this country on.
Great. Hey, Barry, thank you so much for joining us tonight, and I've appreciated your time. The information we can get on the website, so that'll work. And if anybody missed it and went too fast tonight, it'll be up on our website, so it'll always be there. Barry, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure for joining tonight, Michael.
Take care.
Bye.
Good night.
And a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore, for now and evermore. That's all. That's all. Where are those, I am sure, who have told you?
you'll adore. Yeah, it's me that you'll adore. For now and evermore. That's all.
Every night I hope and pray a dream lover will come my way. A girl to hold in my arms and know the magic of her charms. Because I want a girl to call my own. I want a dream lover so I don't have to dream alone. Dream lover, where are you? With a love oh so true and a hand that I can hold to feel you near as I grow old. Because I want a girl to call my own. I want a dream lover.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You are listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Richard O'Leary with us. He's the author of One with the Sea, an inspiring rags-to-riches saga of the son of an Irish immigrant. And he grew up in Maine. Richard grew up in Maine, attended the Maine Maritime Academy in Castine, where he earned a Bachelor of Science degree. He also completed the Alexander Hamilton Institute's course in modern business, and he went on to receive a graduate tuition scholarship from Adelphi University, where he earned a master's in business degree and was awarded an honorary Doctor of Science degree from the Maine Maritime Academy, as well as being one of the first 12 inductees into the institution's Wall of Fame. And let us say, hi, Richard. Welcome to the show.
Hello. Thank you very much. Good evening to you.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. You know, when we look at the maritime, we look at the sea, and we look at all of those things that most people will never get to see and truly don't understand. What was it for you for the sea? You know, being in the U.S. Navy, the Merchant Marines, and you were a commandant of a midshipman at the U.S. Merchant Marine Academy at Kings Point. What was it about the sea that drew you to it?
Just everything. I actually was born 30 miles from the sea on a river that was kind of a smelly river, and I don't know, I guess I first saw the sea at Old Orchard Beach when I was about 7 or 8, and I was just absolutely fascinated. Everything about it, the tide, the freshness of the air, the just everything, and I've stayed that way all my life.
Now, by the way, the travel, the cruise ship owner that you are, I spent a year on cruises in the cruise ships in 1982, I think it was, in the West Indies, and I've got to tell you, it was one of the greatest experiences I've ever had in my entire life. Anybody who really wants to see the world, it's got to get on a ship, get out in the ocean, and go someplace. Yeah, I almost can't even explain what a thrill that is.
I agree with you. I've always been fascinated with the sea, but also with ships that take people out in the water. And something I've always noticed that when a ship is sailing, very few people ever talk about this, and I don't either, but when a ship is sailing, I notice that people touch each other. And that's a pretty neat thing. But it is. It's just absolutely magical.
Yeah. Now, by the way, there is one danger in cruises that I learned, and it was this. You never want to get between a passenger and food.
And there's plenty of opportunity to do that.
No, absolutely. There's no question about it. Now, the book in and of itself, what caused you to put it to pen? Why was it that you decided that you wanted to write about the subject matter, and what is it that you want that audience to know?
Well, I did it very late in life, really. I retired 5 years ago, and I never had any interest in that kind of writing, anything like that. And I had about... not a lot of people, maybe 4 or 5 people used to say, you've had a really interesting life and you ought to write about it. And I used to say, I just don't have any interest in that. And there's one person in particular, in fact, he just left our house here, a guy named Jim Denton, who was, used to work with us for about 7 years, and he went on to become the editor of a World Affairs magazine in Washington and publisher. And he's kind of a real character. I mean, a really, really crazy character. And I love him. And he said to me about a year ago, you know what, if you're too damn lazy to write this, I will. He said, just talk into a machine. That did it. But yeah. I'm not taking that chance.
No, that's
so
good.
I did it.
Now, by the way, having a father from Ireland and having your Irish background, what was it that your dad taught you realistically that caused you to use or caused it to be the base of who you became and the way you did business?
Well, first of all, he was illiterate, really, and he learned to read later and became a very good reader right when he became a citizen, which he lived alone for 14 years here, came all by himself, and he was the most unselfish person I've ever met. He was a human working machine, and all he did was work his heart out to take care of his family. He had no interest in himself. And if you live with someone like that who loves you dearly, you pick up some pretty decent traits. And one of them was to never, ever give up, no matter how hopeless things seem, and to also be good to people.
You know, you couldn't ask for two better life lessons than that, no matter how old you are or what endeavors that you do take on in life. Now, going out to sea, also, you know, besides being absolutely gorgeous and beautiful, it's got those moments that are a little bit scary. Now, for you, what was your moment? Where was it that for you in your life as an officer out there that was the most thrilling part of your existence?
Well, that's a very good question, by the way. I went to sea for a good long time in the Navy and then on freight ships. And then I was assigned to the SS United States, the fastest ship in the world, which was an ocean liner. It carried 2,000 people back and forth from New York to Europe. And I crossed that ocean 250 times. And it's thrilling, I guess. Yeah, thrilling. It was in 1962. We ran into a storm like nothing I'd ever seen, and more importantly, the commodore of the ship had never seen anything like it either. I mean, tremendous. We were stopped, and this is a big, powerful ship with 240,000 horsepower. Mm. We were stopped and taking 70-foot seas over the bow, coming onto the foredeck and smashing up into the bridge. And I remember on here, and I had never been afraid at sea, and I'd been in all kinds of bad weather, but I remember ducking down on the bridge. And the fleeting thought going through my head, oh, my God, is it all going to end like this on the greatest ship in the world? And as always, the wind abated, the seas moderated, and it got better, and we arrived in France 14 hours late. But I'll never forget that. And it always reminded me of the mariner's prayer, Lord, thy ocean is so great, and my ship is so small. Even the SS United States, which was 1,000 feet long.
Well, you know, we go through life and we go back to those memories. That memory in and of itself, what did that do for your life? How did that make you look at life just a little bit differently? You know, you get to that point in life where it may be it. I mean, there might not be any more life, just like you said, will this cause it to be over? But at the same time, it makes a change in you. Where was the change for you?
Yeah, yes, it did. It made me realize that, well, God is great, for one thing, and also some of my father's lessons. He only crossed the ocean once when he came to this country all alone when he was 19 years old, that the ocean is mighty and God is mighty, and yet don't give up. You know, we came through it okay, and so did the 3,000 people on the ship. Bad situations are bad, but they many times get better.
Oh, no question about it. I remember some rough weather back when I was in that year that I spent on the cruise ships. And I will never forget the feeling of it, because I understand exactly what they meant before Columbus sailed, when they thought the world was flat. Because you can be in the middle of the ocean and you can look out on a clear day. It looks like it goes to a particular point, drops off, and it's over with. And it does.
We were talking about that today, and I'm starting to read David McCullough's book about the people that went to Paris, and not John Adams and the big celebrities, but, and it's a wonderful book, and he talks about how horrific those voyages were then. I can just imagine going across there on a sailing ship, but but if you notice, if you do look at a horizon and you see a ship out there, you'll see it will slowly go down until it's half there, and then which kind of indicates there's a big curve there.
No question. By the way, Cruise International, I want to do this. We've got a few minutes to go.
Yeah.
What do I get on the ship? What am I going to see? What am I going to experience? What is it about that that's going to make it a very special time for me?
Oh, you mean on one of my harbor ships, like the Spirit of
yes.
Chicago? Yeah, well, the concept there that I came up with, I love big ships, and I guess because I was on the SS United States for 5 years, and I love ships that take people in the water. And the typical cruise ship, I suppose, like you were on, is usually a one-week voyage, and it has good food and entertainment, good food and good food. Yeah. And anyway, so I had the idea of compressing the elements of that big cruise into 3 hours. And I did some stumbling. I had an old ship that was always breaking down for us, but what we had on there is dining, two live bands, and a Broadway review, which was unique in that the review was done by the waiters and waitresses, and it was pretty smashing. We used to move, we had 13 of them at one time, including the Spirit of Chicago, and we were moving 1,700 people per day and 1.5 million people per year. So it became stumbling start, but it became very successful. And the one in Chicago, I think, has always been successful. But when I built it and brought it out there and went to Navy Pier, I imagine it's still there. I'm not sure.
Yeah, by the way, one of the ships that I was on, and I only did about 2 weeks on it, I was on the QE2. And I'll tell you.
Oh, yeah, I know that ship well.
That's a big ship.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is.
And I'll tell you what I saw that was very interesting that not many people would see. I was on just about the time that England went to war with the Balkans. Remember that, like in 81?
Yes, I do.
Okay, I'm on the cruise ship, right? And a lot of the kids that were on that ship, and I wasn't a passenger. They hired me to do certain things, and the kids on the ship they played together, they loved together, they were just close as you could be. And when the two countries went to war, quote unquote, you saw people who were just wonderful friends and family become enemies. And I watched the other kids get off the ship. One of the most interesting things that I've ever seen. They were great until that particular time happened, and then all of a sudden it was completely separated. And by the way, let me tell you why I'm glad your dog is barking. Because my three, which are about 100 pounds apiece, do the same thing. And for once, it's not my fault.
they're two standard poodles. We had three when died from. Yeah. Can I ask you a question?
Sure,
what were you
ahead.
Doing on the ships?
Oh, I was an entertainer in those days.
Doing what?
Oh, I've never mentioned it on the air before.
Okay, don't.
Yeah, it's not bad. I just never mentioned. I was a stage hypnotist.
The what?
I was a stage hypnotist.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah, and and I traveled all over the place, and I was hired from the different ships, et cetera, and I would have shows and workshops and things on the ships.
Good job.
Oh, yeah, it was fun. It was fun. Let me tell you, the greatest time that I ever had, they brought on passengers. They rented the ship, and they brought on passengers from, where was it? It was, where do they speak Portuguese? Is it in Buenos Aires? Argentina.
Mm-hmm.
They brought people in from Argentina.
No.
I love the dogs. It's okay. They brought people in from, even applauding the show. They brought people in from Argentina and spoke Portuguese, did not speak the language. I'm supposed to go out and do a show that night, right? So I got an interpreter. And I stood there and I did the induction, and the guy standing next to me interpreted into English, and people were dropping all over the stage, and this guy that was doing it frightened him. He was talking, and people were hypnotized all over the room. It was hysterical. Yeah. By the way, I've never said that on the air before in 28 years, but that's what I did.
That's amazing.
Yeah, amazing. All the good stuff over a period of time. Okay, now, website we can find you at.
Pardon me? Website?
Yeah, what website we can find you at?
Yeah, onewiththecbook.com.
Okay, onewiththecbook.com. Now, as you leave us, is there a thought you want to leave us with? And by the way, one of the thoughts that we want to talk about leaving us with also is the ability to be able to get information to do a cruise.
Yeah. Well, one of the harbor or the lake cruises in Chicago, you merely look up and call. But, there's so many opportunities to be on ships like you were on, and to try to get good deals through travel agents, through wholesalers, calling the company directly, learning how to book at the right time when you can, if the right time you can almost go half price. It's kind of a big subject, but it's not hard to do.
Okay, and we can get a lot of it on the a lot of the information on the website.
Yes, yes.
Okay, super. You know, by the way, in 28 years, I've never said that on the air before, so we'll keep that between you and I. We won't tell anybody.
Okay, you and I in the audience, Michael.
Absolutely. Hey, listen, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
And thank you very much. Thank you. I appreciate it.
Take care. Good night.
Good night.
There are so many fabulous faraway places to see, such as Mexico, Sweden, Hawaii, Japan, and Capri. There's so many exciting and wonderful places, mountains and jungles and desert oases, pleasant as home is, it isn't what Rome is, so why stay there? So many fabulous faraway places to see. Why should Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me? I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London, wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see. There are so many simply incredible places to see. When I think of the warm Caribbean, I see a new world for you and me. I'd give anything just to have one single day there. And once we get there, I know that we'll stay there. Stay in those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London, Siam and Siena, Vienna, Verona, Java, Jamaica, Bombay, Barcelona. Show me those fabulous places we're longing to see.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You are listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. She's back, Susan Marshall, President, Executive Advisor, LLC, how to grow a backbone, 10 strategies for gaining power and influence at work. That's the book, creator of the Backbone Institute. I can say that word. Susan, welcome back. How are
Hi,
you?
Hi, Michael Ray. How are you this evening?
Not very confident because I can't solve all these problems I have.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
Yeah. Is that tough? Is that a problem for you?
It's really, I'm having a terrible problem with that. I get stuck when I can't solve these things, and then I lose confidence, and I don't feel like I'm competent.
I've seen that.
Yes,
I've seen
that
more and more lately. And you know, with our the leaders, supposed leaders of the world, actually not helping any of us with the confidence things, people really are struggling with this. And two things happen: they either get paralyzed. Right, they slow way down because you sort of muse, and then you get the people sit on their pity pot and get stuck, or they fire up the engines, run Mach 2 with their hair on fire, so they just don't have time to pay attention to any problems. And in both cases, confidence suffers. So, of course, being the backbone person, competence, yes, confidence risk-taking, you start looking at what's the tie between building competence or getting good at things and building confidence. And what made me think about this is I was working with a woman about a year ago. She had lost her husband, not real recently, but within the last 18 months prior to my working with her, in a motorcycle accident during the summer. She was living in the log cabin home that he had built by hand, and she hated her job. So she was grieving, of course. She had a loss. Her job was paying the bills, but she hated it. And she was surrounded by things that her husband had created, had built. But she was stuck. And so we started talking about things that she could do just to get moving. And we talk about inertia, right? When a body at rest will stay at rest, the body in motion will stay in motion unless some external force is exerted. Well, we needed to exert some force to get her out of the inertia of being stuck. And we started talking about things she could do. Well, when you're not in a good frame of mind, it's like you could make a list of stuff, but you really don't feel like doing it, which adds to the sort of the misery, the conundrum. I can't solve, I can't solve, I can't solve. But what happened was, I learned in working with her that she loved making cards, greeting cards. She had stamps, she had colored paper, she had all these the crafty things. But she hadn't done it in, I don't know, 5 or 6 years, I think she said. So I encouraged her to start making cards. And she said, well, I don't know what to say. I said, for the time being, say nothing. So she started creating cards for her kids. For the daughter, she made butterflies. She would do sunflowers. She did magnolia trees because those were all things that her daughter liked. For her son, she would just use different textures and different colors. And what happened was, as she started making the cards, she started recognizing that she truly could do stuff. Little tiny thing. She liked doing it. She had walked away from it. She had forgotten it. But she reminded herself that she had that competence to make those cards. And what it did for her was it made her wonder what else she could do that she either had done before but had forgotten about or walked away from, or that she had never tried but could. And so the confidence obviously fueled the energy to say, okay, what else might I do?
She became
what
competent.
What might I learn? She what?
She became competent.
Yes.
In what she was doing.
And refreshed her competence in the little card-making thing. But that triggered her to ask the question, rather than ruminating on the job she didn't like or, you know, the fact that she lived in this house that her husband built and he's now gone, she began to wonder what else she could do. And I worked with her for about 6 months. I had a note from her a couple of months ago. She's got a new job. She's not dating yet. She said she's not sure she's ever going to do that, but she has a new job. Her life, as she wrote it to me, she said, my life has color again.
Yeah.
Her confidence is back. And it's not a magical thing. It's not something that, you know, if I go for a walk, for example, that's my favorite thing. I get stuck. I'm writing something. I'll get stuck and I'll go for a walk. And I'll just look at things. I'll notice people. I'll listen to, you know, kids laugh. I'll look at the color of the sky, whatever it is. And it changes my brain chemistry. It takes the problem that I was gnawing at or trying to work through, and it puts it on the back burner. And all of the other stuff brings in new energy, and it brings a different perspective. I'll hear a kid say something, and I'll think, that's a phrase I can use. Or the color of the sky will trigger a phrase that I just wasn't able to put together. That sense of competence, it's a sense of agency that people like to talk about. And that means that you teach yourself, literally teach yourself that you can do things.
Oh, by the way, a couple of your talking points, which I thought was great, and it's to elevate your confidence, do something on purpose. Write a letter to a loved one that states clearly what's in your heart and on your mind. But the second one, the third one is clean out a closet, which is almost the same thing, isn't it?
Yes. Very, very good. Yeah, and the letter writing thing is not, I don't suggest that to get people to give it to the other person, but to go through the discipline of clarifying their thinking. Cleaning out a closet is the similar, you know, get the junk out, organize it, and put it back in a way that makes sense. Clear out the clutter.
Have you ever written a blame letter?
No, what's a blame letter?
Oh, they're wonderful. Okay. We used to do this all the time. I would conduct a workshop, and I would have people write a blame letter. Because of you, I was this, and you did that to me, and you were this, and you were that. Great blame letter. Okay. Now, by the way, am I coming through okay, or am I bouncing off the
wall? No, you're good.
Okay. Yeah, so it's the write the blame letter. You did this, you did that. And I watched the audience sit there as they were putting the letter together, and I started watching tears come out of people's eyes. And there were certain people crying, and you could see the effect of the blame letter. And I said, you know, would somebody like to read the blame letter? You know, your blame letter. And a young woman got up and she said, well, when you did this, I was this way and this is how I felt and you crushed me and you did this and you did that. And she started crying and I said, okay, let's change something. Everything in that letter, instead of saying you did, say I did. Every time you're going to say you, say I. Instead of you, say me. And she started to reread the letter. When I did this to myself, I caused me to be this. When I did that to my, And I'll tell you what, that was a cleared room by the time we were done.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah, absolutely.
It is. Well, I was reading something the other day about people, sort of neurotics and character disordered people, right? And how difficult it can be to help people take responsibility for where they are. And the blame letter is just beautiful for that. I'm here, I don't like being here, and it's everybody else's fault. It's your fault, it's his fault, it's, you know, the weather's fault, it's the government's fault, it's my boss's fault, whatever. And until, and when you do that exercise, I love it, and you start looking at, well, you know what, that I did this to me in this situation. I interpreted my boss's feedback as negative or nasty. He was having a bad day. When we can help people understand they have the opportunity to create good circumstances for themselves, you change people's lives. And you think about confidence. It's a belief that something good will happen because of something you did. It's also the belief that when a bad thing happens because something you did, you can try something else.
Sure.
And that's the talking points, the things, right? Do something on purpose. Generally speaking, what I ask people to do is keep a list of things to do. Take inventory of the household goods. Write the letter. Clean out a closet. Take a class. Get a piece of paper and draw the situation you're struggling with. Ride your bike. Go for a walk. A guy that I worked with a couple of months ago, when he got stuck, he'd go change the oil in the lawnmower.
Sure.
Make a list of things like that that need to be done that, you know, for me it was cleaning the windows. I finally hired somebody. But then keep a journal of the things you've done. That's a powerful, powerful tool when people get stuck to go back to the journal and read, I did. I walked 2 miles. I changed the oil in the lawnmower. I made cards for my kids that they keep to this day. I cut the grass, you know, I cleaned out my closet, whatever it is. Accomplishment, accomplishment, accomplishment. And it's not only that record of things that they did that ended up pleasing them. It's a display of all kinds of capabilities that we forget about when we're stressed.
Ask me what I do when I get stressed.
What do you do when you get stressed?
Funny you should say that. Barney the beat-up bag.
Ah,
I go beat up on my you know, the big heavyweight boxer bags.
Yes, Sure.
Yeah, no, I will beat up on Barney. And he said, that's what I'm here for. Hit me again. I love it. That's my purpose in life.
And what happens then?
Well, it gets the energy. I gets the, yes. It gets that excess out, and I'm calmed down. Yep. Now I don't have it all built up in me.
Yeah. Endorphins. You released endorphins into your system.
You bet. And every time physically. I smack Barney, I got a shot of dopamine. Right from the pleasure
side. Well, so there you go. Self-medicating in a very, very healthy way.
Absolutely.
That kind of activity, as simple as it is improving competence. You know how to de-stress yourself, which elevates your confidence.
No, absolutely. It's a come down and I'll work the bag and I'm out of breath. Let me tell you where I learned that years ago. I had horses for years and years and years and years. And I remember there was a particular horse that I got that he was a running quarter. He was a quarter horse. And So I, it wasn't that one. It was the Bucks. It was Admiral High. He was a buckskin Appaloosa. And what happened with Admiral, he got cinch bound. And when I put the saddle on him and I start to pull the cinch up, the horse would go up, rear up, over, and down. And he put a fear in me that I just couldn't get rid of. So the trainer was about, she was about a quarter of a mile away at the most. So what I would do is I would jump on him and we would go over to her place. And you know what a round pen is?
Yes.
So what she would do is she would get me in the round pen with the horse, and I had the crop, and I would chase the horse around, and the horse would be loping round and round, and I'd be chasing the horse and whack it in the butt. And by the time I was done, I was so out of breath, exhausted, and tired, the fear was gone.
Yeah. Isn't that amazing?
And every time that I got the fear, I'd run him around the round pen, and the fear was gone. Now, that didn't stop him from doing what he was doing, but it allowed me to get rid of the fear to be able to work with him.
Well, and that is exactly the essence here of what we're talking about. You got good at getting rid of the fear. You gained control of your own self, for lack of a better way to say it, which then enabled you to take care of the horse.
If you scare me, go ahead.
Well, people are the same.
Yeah.
When we encounter other people we don't know how to deal with, we start blaming, write the blame letter.
Rather
than
beat up Barney.
Back and saying, but step back and say, what can I get better at in this situation? And I had a classic example. The young professionals now are all, the old bosses are dumb. They don't know technology. They're slow. They're all this kind of thing. And when I can help them step back and say, but look at the institutional wisdom these people have. They know how deals get cut. They understand when somebody is saying yes and meaning no. They know the industry. They know people. They know how to make it, all of that kind of stuff. Then they're like, wow, okay, So checking assumptions, but more than that, getting people to get better at doing things, not thinking things. And you know me, I'm a thinker. I love to think. But you got to be doing things on purpose to get past the logjam of a problem. So many people now just struggling without jobs, not knowing what to do. No money. How am I going to pay my bills? Well, and in fact, just walked through this with my brother, who was out of a job for 6 months, 7 months. Went to the bank, said, credit card companies are calling me. I can't pay my mortgage until either I sell the house or I get a job. And for 7 months, he worked, talked with them.
Yeah.
Gave him a sense that he had done something. The collectors still called him. He simply reminded them of the conversation they had last time. Said, I know you're doing your job. When I get a job, I'll start paying again. Rather than closing himself up at his house, cracking a beer, and, trying to think his way into something different. Tough to do. But he also went out, he's a builder, so put new siding on his house and, get a new roof and all that kind of thing. But
see,
they
all this garbage
kept moving.
Susan, all this garbage they give us about positive thinking,
mm-hmm.
It's garbage. It doesn't do anything. It's neutral. You can be stuck in a hole and somebody say, think positive. Well, good. I'm thinking positive, but I'm still stuck in the hole. If somebody gives me a ladder, I'll climb out. It's not positive thinking. It's the bridge to move to through to appropriate thinking.
And activity.
Yeah.
That supports movement. And sometimes the activity, you do something and you recognize, you know, a week or so later, that was really dumb. I probably shouldn't have done that. Okay, but now if I'm keeping a journal of things that I've done, I can go back and look at what I did and say, okay, this was the outcome I expected. Didn't happen that way. What do I need to do different? And, oh, by the way, when I've got some measure of confidence, I can say, I need to do something different. Not just, geez, I screwed that up, I'm an idiot, I'm done. And so it becomes, it's habit, of course. And what's troubling to me, you know, we're watching all these flash mobs and we're watching kids being patted on the head and, you know, shuffled off to the next grade without having learned much. We are sowing the seeds of incompetence and lack of confidence.
You know what they grow up to be? Jurors.
Oh, dear. Yeah, well, there you go. There's the tie to the news. It's frightening when you think about it.
Yeah.
And
no question,
It's unnecessary.
No, I got it loud and clear, and I think what's going on, because people aren't doing what you're talking about doing, they're living their lives stuffed. And when I say stuffed, they won't show anything emotionally, because if they do, they're going to get hurt for it.
Yeah.
So they hide in the computers, they hide in the games, they hide in all of these places where the human touch doesn't exist anymore.
And yet the rage builds. The frustration, I was thinking about this, you know, just the terrible stories over the 4th of July holidays of violence and gangs and mobs and people just out of control.
Well, how many people was it? Where was this? East side of where?
River West.
Oh, River West. You know where that's at?
River West, in Milwaukee.
Did you hear what happened? There was about 50 kids out of control beating people up and rioting.
Yes. And I just heard a brief bit from the police chief Flynn, who was saying, you know, we have to be careful about, you know, making assumptions or whatever. He was being very, very careful about not talking about facts, because the facts, and I saw some of the video, they trashed the BP station, went in and stole black kids. But we don't want to fuel racial tensions, so we cannot talk about facts.
Yeah. Now, by the way, that's the second or third time this has happened in the last couple of 3 weeks in the country. 50 kids at one time doing exactly what happened here.
Well, and I don't know whether they've looked at, you know, the social media. This happened at Mayfair Mall in the spring. They had kids, you know, on Twitter and Facebook saying, hey, show up at Mayfair, we're going to trash the place.
Yeah.
And so somewhere they're getting the idea that They can
get away with it.
Yeah. And, oh, my goodness, you know, all the social ills that we can talk about and, you know, no families and no discipline, mom and dad chasing their 15 minutes of fame, whatever that is. We are not building competence or confidence in these kids. And by not doing that, we are destroying their future. Destroying their future.
No, I hear it. Well, you know what we should do? And I know he's listening right now. All of those kids should get vitamin D3.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it'll stop them from doing it.
And then make them go for a walk.
Yeah, I got it. So there's a website we can find you at.
www.executiveadvisorllc.com.
Wonderful. Hey, thanks, and I will see you next week. We will be sitting here waiting impatiently for you to come back.
Thank you, Michael Ray. You have a great evening.
Good night.
Bye-bye.
I can only give you love that lasts forever, and the promise to be near each time you call, and the only heart I own for you and you alone. That's all. I can only give you country walks in springtime, and a hand to hold when leaves begin to fall, and a love whose burning light will warm the winter night. That's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy.
If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore, for now and evermore. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all.
And he is back with us again, Dr. Mayor Eisenstein. He is the author of Don't Vaccinate Before You Educate. He's CEO of Home First Natural Pharmaceuticals. Mayor, welcome back.
Oh, Michael, welcome. You know, I hope you had a wonderful July 4th weekend.
We did. I blew everything up.
I blew everything up, you know. Well, I'm still in Florida because my youngest son got married in Miami on Sunday. And we had just an incredibly wonderful time. It was just, you know, and we're back here in Orlando for the week. It's been just heavenly. What can I say? You know, heavenly.
That's great. You know, how old is your boy?
25.
Ah, that's a great age to get married.
Yeah, you know, and married to a very lovely young woman, you know, and couldn't ask for more, you know. And I can tell you what, all my children, I had all six of my children there, you know, and all of my daughters, my four daughters, love her. And, you know, that's pretty hard when you can't, and my daughter-in-law's. And so, you know, it's like pretty hard to get someone that everyone likes. It's usually one person, I don't care for this person. That's, you know, that's wonderful. But I got some really important stuff for me to talk about. You know, we talked a lot about vitamin D, and you know, I heard you just talk a minute ago about what those boys should be taking there. You know, maybe it'll help them, you know. Michael, tell everyone which vitamin D should they be taking.
It's the D3.
That's exactly right, you know, and but I can tell you something that's just important we haven't talked about for a long time. And sometimes the Food and Drug Administration actually comes up with some important stuff. And a couple of days ago, they came out with a report, a link between proton pump inhibitors and hip fractures confirmed. You know, I tell you why this is so important, because it's one of the big problems as we get a little bit older, especially. And we're talking about not old, we're talking about over 50. We're not talking about people who are real old. I mean, and they found that taking Nexium, Prevacid, Prilosec, Protonix, any of these acid-blocking medications, which are now available also over-the-counter, there's a Prevacid over-the-counter, increase your hip fractures. And it's confirmed, because we've known about this for at least 10 years, and it's become the mainstay in our society. These are drugs that are taken for heartburn, acid reflux, it's overwhelming. It's not like it's a little change. It's a massive change. In fact, they looked at 80,000 postmenopausal women who were enrolled for the last 20 years in nurses' health study. They found that the percentages were overwhelming in the women who took up the proton pump inhibitors. And they said, how long should you take it? No more than 6 weeks. That's it. You know, Michael, that most people are taking this, when the millions are taking for years at a time.
Well, now, when you talked about hip, does it have an effect on bone?
Oh, well, they just looked at hip, but it was in fractures across the board. Okay. It's all bones. What it does is, if you take these, they're very effective, these acid blocker drugs. What they do is they get rid of your heartburn, but they also mean you can't absorb vitamin D, you can't absorb calcium, you can't absorb anything, because those require an acid environment. And so what we're doing is our bones are becoming soft, because they become depleted of the calcium that we need in order to have strong bones. And no matter what you do, it doesn't make a difference. And they even looked at people who took high levels of calcium, high levels of vitamin D. It didn't change anything. The only thing that changed it is they stopped taking the proton pump inhibitors. Within 2 years of stopping, the increase in bone fracture went away.
Now, by the way, well, can't we, and I say we, as a country, as a unit, can't we project with some of these things, or are we back to somebody's going to make some money and the research wasn't quite what it should have been?
Well, you know, it's kind of we're a country which takes drugs to solve problems. And we kind of never think in terms, let's take the most honest intentions, and no one saw this coming. Let's take, you know, our answer is always to look for a drug to solve a problem, as opposed to a more natural means. You know, we've talked about this a couple of years ago, but we haven't talked about it for a while because there's so many other issues. But the majority of people who take the proton pump inhibitors, and let's go back to the simplest ones. These aren't proton pump inhibitors, but I guarantee you no one even looked at this. Tums, Rolaids, you know, we're talking about the simpler type of acid blockers are going to have also increased risk. I'm predicting this because it makes sense, because if it blocks the acid, it's always going to happen. But we forgot about what causes these things. You know, we've gotten away from the simple things that your grandmother and my grandmother knew. We're eating too fast. We're not chewing our food well enough. We're drinking too much fluid with our meals, so we're washing the food into our stomach before it gets digested. So now the acid that we're producing is in response to huge pieces of undigested food, as opposed to ones that are chewed very well. We almost have to eat like the mother bird feeds their little birds, their babies. By the mother bird chews the food first, then puts it in the baby's mouth, so it's already pre-digested.
So realistically, it's not what you eat, it's how you eat.
That's exactly right. I mean, of course, what you eat will have an effect, but I guarantee you it's almost more how you eat, you know. And then, of course, you know, there's simple things, digestive enzymes, probiotics. We have a great, great product as a combination of the two, you know. But the more important thing is really how you eat is the biggest impact, you know, as such. Of course, there's foods that you should avoid, you know. But one of the reasons why they're problematic is also, you said it so perfectly, how we eat.
By the way, let me ask you this. Are you talking about the betonade?
Betonade, yes.
Well, say it again.
Betonade. Betonade, it's a Hebrew word for betonate stomach, so betonate is aid for the stomach, and it's a very interesting product, you know. It's a chewable digestive enzyme with probiotics, you know, and what
can
it
you
seems
OD
to
on
do
it?
Is... Pardon?
Can you OD on it?
No, can't OD on it, because, you know, the amount of probiotics that we have in our body is in the trillions. These are the friendly bacteria in the trillions, you know. And here we're talking about just small amounts. We're talking about the millions or billions. I mean, and what it does is, but it seems that the probiotics, and we've really learned that you can put probiotics into many substances, and it enhances its potency and absorption. So what happens is, when you put it together with digestive enzymes, it enhances the potency and absorption of the digestive enzymes, which helps you digest the food that's in your stomach. So there's two approaches to heartburn or acid reflux. One approach is, let's get rid of the acid in your stomach. The second approach is not to get rid of the acid, but let's digest the food so your body doesn't have to produce as much acid. And that approach is an old approach, you know, which works very, very well. But, of course, the answers are very simple, it allows us to lead our lifestyle of eating in the car, eating quickly, not digesting our food, going along with more pharmaceuticals. Now, let me tell you why it's so important, because it's been shown. And, you know, I've for 30 years I suffered from massively overweight. Now I'm just a little bit overweight, you know, God willing, getting there. But one of the things that I've learned is that it takes the body 20 to 25 minutes to know that you've eaten something. So many people, a few people like Michael Ray, he can eat quickly, and be satisfied. But most people who eat too quickly, what happens is they're hungry again because the body didn't realize that it had eaten. You know, they didn't take enough time to eat, and it sounds crazy, but, you know, that's what my grandmother used to say, sit down at the table, don't bring any books with you, turn off the TV, you know, eat slowly, because she knew intuitively it takes a while to understand that you're full, and so I think we've got to really reevaluate how we eat, even more important than what we eat, because if we reevaluate how we eat, that's going to cut down on our consumption by 20-30% right there.
Mayor, the betonate is kind of interesting because I'll eat, and about a half hour afterwards, I'll take about three of them, and then I find myself going back for more. They taste like candy.
They taste like candy, you know, because they're flavored with stevia and xylitol, you know, and there's no sugar in them. They're not addictive as such, you know, but they really do. I find the same thing. I use them. I use them in our vitamin C. We've got a chewable vitamin C with probiotics, also a flavor with stevia and xylitol. I use that if I have a taste for something sweet, which is healthy for you. I used to have heartburn all the time, and interestingly, even before I lost an ounce of weight, we figured out that using the chewable digestive enzymes with probiotics, the betonate, you can avoid all heartburn, and which is so interesting because that's not been a problem that I've had, even though most people who are more than 100 pounds overweight will suffer from heartburn all the time.
You know, no question about it. And what I've seen with the betonate, I'll take it. And then within a very short period of time, it starts to take effect. And it works for me. And again, it tastes, quote unquote, it tastes like candy. I find myself going back to get a couple of them.
Yeah, no, and my wife keeps them in the car. I mean, so that way, we used to have unhealthy things in the car, no matter what, or calories in the car. You don't need calories in the car. You know, we used to have nuts and raisins, which aren't unhealthy foods. But we've talked about this many times, you know, and clearly the issue of overweight in this country is too many calories. There's no question about that. You can get about it. And we're going to talk about body composition in the next couple of weeks because I've done a lot of work on that now, and I'm very, very fascinated by some of the stuff on body composition, you know. And it still comes down to, I think, let me throw a teaser out for the next couple of weeks, and that is, each pound of muscle that you have burns about 30 to 35 calories a day. Each pound of fat that you're in your body burns 0 calories a day. Because the fat's there to store energy. It's not there. So if you have 50 pounds of fat, I'm just throwing out that number, and someone else only has 10 pounds of fat, the person they will burn, the person with 50 pounds of fat will have a calorie requirement that's no different than the person who's got 10 pounds. Let's assume they have this equal amount of muscle, which means the more muscle you have and the less fat, you know, the more your body burns, you know, and that's one of the reasons why on any calorie-restricted program that doesn't just burn fat, it burns muscle, you're going to, let's say you burn 10 pounds of muscle, and that's what happens, and you lose 20 pounds, burn 10 pounds of muscle, you have to eat 300 or 400 calories a day less in order to maintain the new weight. If you lose only 1 or 2 pounds of muscle and 18 pounds of fat, well, so now you're 20 pounds lighter, but both people will have a different caloric need at the end of that weight loss program.
You know, it's interesting with the different caloric need. And what I've seen, what I've been exposed to recently, is that, and I've talked about for years and years and years, I've been in discussions with and about different behavioral types. Based on those behavioral types are how you're going to match up in communication. There's also different eating types, which I'm becoming aware of. I hadn't paid attention to it, and I'm starting to see that now. And if you can tie in your eating type with the way that you create that program that's going to cause you to lose weight, I wonder if that couldn't be an answer to something that people are
looking for. I think that's an answer, but I think it's a very small part of the picture because that people have tied that now for 25 years, and the changes have been minor. Some people have benefited greatly, but most people it makes no difference because the bottom line still is it's calories in, calories out, no matter. And that's why all these weight programs talk about having an exercise program with it, because they know, I don't care if it's Weight Watchers, Jenny Craig, Nutrisystem, Seattle Sutton, most of what you're going to lose in those programs is muscle, and they know unless you start working out to build the muscle back up, you know, you're going to put the weight right back on, because all you've done is lost muscle, and the body's going to crave to put that weight back on.
No question. And you know what I do every time that you get on? I take all my notes, and then I do the reverse of it so I can gain weight.
Yeah, that's exactly. You know, but you fall. Well, you know, and just one last tidbit. No one should think that they're going to work out to lose weight. Anyone who wants to work out is supposed to build muscle, you know, but not to lose weight, but to actually put on muscle in itself.
Yeah, absolutely. Mayor, a website we can find you at?
Homefirst.com. That's HOMEFIRST.com. You know, and we have a lot of construction on our website, so a lot of things are new. They're just, it's homefirst.com. The store is working. Our HCG program is working. And some of the other modules are going to be coming up, you know. But you can read a lot about all the different things in our store right now. Michael, always a pleasure.
Hey, see you next week.
Thank you. Be well. Be well, my friend.
Good night.
So many fabulous faraway places to see. Why should Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me? I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London. Wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see. There are so many simply incredible places to see. When I think of the warm Caribbean, I see a new world for you and me. I'd give anything just to have one single day there. And once we get there, I know that we'll stay there. Stay in those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London, Siam, Siena, Vienna, Verona, Java, Jamaica, Bombay, Barcelona. Show me those fabulous places we're longing to see.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Deborah Sweeney is with us. We're going to talk about the new tax issue that's affecting small businesses and big online retailers who now will have to charge sales tax. It's called the Amazon Tax Law. She's the CEO of My Corporation Business Services. Deborah Sweeney is an advocate for protecting personal and business assets for all consumers. And with her experience in the field of corporate and intellectual property law, she can provide insightful commentary on the benefit, the barriers, and who should consider incorporation and trademark registration. She's also has extensive experience in the startup and entrepreneurial industry, as she's been involved in the formation of hundreds of thousands of MyCorporation.com's customers. And let us say, Deborah, hi, welcome to the show.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. California, did I hear right recently that Northern California wants to secede from Southern California?
That's probably true. Although I'm from Southern California, and I can say it's a nice place, and we do well as one group together.
I was brought up in Southern California, but I was brought up at a time when if you drove from L.A. to San Diego, San Diego was a sleepy little town of 50,000, and there was nothing but little beach towns in between.
Right. Nope. Not the case anymore, right?
300 years ago. I got it. California right now, they're starting to create taxing online sales. Is this something brand new?
It is. It's brand new in the sense that they're taxing online sales from out-of-state purchases, and so that is the bigger change. So people have typically been used to the fact that they could buy from out-of-state and not have to pay the California taxes unless the originator, the company that made the sale, was actually in California. And that tends now not to be the case with the new laws, and it's expanding sort of state after state, and so it's becoming more and more of an issue that has to be, you know, addressed.
Okay, so let's say, for instance, that I have a small business, and you become a client of mine, and you're in California. Does that mean I would have to tax you for the interaction that we've had, and whatever it is that you purchase?
Usually the one thing that doesn't have to address is that if it's a service, it doesn't necessarily apply. But if it's a product, a tangible property, then it does. And to answer your question, yes, if you're in California and I'm a California business, then you're collecting sales tax on the product, I'm having to pay sales tax. The interesting factor was that a lot of people, and Amazon tends to be one that is a target, but that's not, you know, not based in California and doesn't necessarily have contacts in California. Now, just because either they're potentially advertising in California or someone who is based in California has a link on their site that directs a customer to Amazon, that is sufficient to require, even though Amazon doesn't have physical presence in California, to have to charge taxes in the state of California and pay taxes, of course.
Of course. Now, but so in essence, now is it, well, before I ask the next question, is this law yet?
So it is in California. It actually applies under the sales and use tax law, and it became, under the State Board of Equalization, they now effectively can impose these taxes.
Oh, now you mentioned that if you're a service, Deborah, if you don't have a product, etc., services, so we should be clear on this. But let's say, for instance, I do have a product. Who's going to get hit? Who's going to be the main players here?
So the main players would be, first of all, of course, your retailer, like Amazon, for example, who used to not have what's called Nexus in the state of California, and now, by virtue of Amazon using smaller businesses like referrers or marketers that would post information on their sites, they would get commission from Amazon. The fact that those exist in the state of California means that they have now created Nexus, which means that they too are affected, because Amazon basically says, forget it, now I'm not doing business in California anymore, otherwise I'm going to get taxed. So they back out and start saying to their advertisers, we're not going to allow you to advertise our services anymore. And now not only is Amazon hit with the tax, but the people who have been advertising for them are now shut off, and they can no longer make money off of the commission or revenue that they were generating from referring business to Amazon.
Okay, so that, now we're talking about state tax. Do you see the federal government getting involved?
So there is issue or discussion, and Amazon actually says that they're for sort of a broader-based application of the taxation across the entire federal government. But with that said, there's a lot of people that say that Amazon's saying that, but really it's just sort of an extension so that it pushes off any additional tax legislation that's not in their favor. I think the notion is, hey, you know, maybe the federal government will never be able to agree across all 50 states on what the tax should be and the standard rate across all 50 states. So while Amazon kind of infers that, hey, that's what they're looking for, is one sort of national tax rate, maybe that's not actually the case. They'd rather just be based on a state-by-state basis. And for those states in which they collect taxes, Kansas, Kentucky, New York, North Dakota, and Washington, that's where they have their offices. That's where they agree to be taxed. That's where the nexus exists. Other than those, they don't want to be paying taxes.
Well, Deborah, I can see a problem here, and then the problem would be this. Unless there was a universal tax, let's say I'm just going to pick a state. Let's say I'm in Wisconsin, no taxes here. But then California, there are taxes there. So if I sell something to somebody in California and there's tax on it, as opposed to selling somebody in Wisconsin where there's no tax, doesn't that put me in a competitive situation whereby the California people, would they like product, etc., are going to lose money because they can't afford to keep up with me because they're being charged a tax and I'm not?
Absolutely, and that's where everybody in California says that this is horrible for California, because now the businesses that were here are not only not paying taxes, but now they're leaving. So we're not only not getting the revenue that we would have gotten when they sold to Amazon, for example, they're now actually leaving the state and not wanting to do business here at all, and that creates a problem. And so those states are seeing less and less revenue, potentially, rather than the more that they were expecting to see. And I think, frankly, the way that Amazon's trying to get kind of back at this whole ruling is to say, fine, we're pulling out altogether. Well, now it's the opposite of what was hoped for, which was the gain of substantial revenue. It's now the loss of substantial revenue because they're not making any money. Amazon's saying, we don't have a nexus. We're not paying taxes. There's no gain to be made by California now at this point.
Deborah, they should have seen the writing on the wall. This is the exact same thing that happened when we went competitive globally. We have a manufacturer here who does whatever the manufacturing product is, but they also have to charge the Social Security taxes, the FICA, the so on and so forth, where another country doesn't do that. And because of that, it threw us out of a competitive nature, and that's why we lost a tremendous amount of business.
It's very true, and it's become quite obvious now as new states are looking at these taxes. They're saying, we already saw what happened in other states, states where the bills currently apply, Texas, Colorado, Illinois, now California. And in fact, today, Massachusetts just declined to pass a bill in this matter because they're seeing the writing on the wall and realizing that this isn't going to be an effective mechanism. Eventually, Amazon would have to crumble. They couldn't continue to pull out of every single state as each state went along, but they've done a pretty successful in doing it, especially as it relates to California.
Do you think that California is going to come out of its financial mess? And it's in a great financial mess right now. And do you see any clarity for it down the road?
Well, gosh, we're certainly optimistic, especially as we talk about small businesses. We talk to small businesses every day that are looking to incorporate, and a large percentage incorporate in California because there's lots of consumers here and a huge potential. So we see a huge optimism on the horizon with the people who are incorporating and forming corporations and LLCs with our business. But I think that there's still that sort of concern about the long-term viability. How is it going to come out, and what are the ramifications? And if it continues to be things like this, implicating sales tax collection, legislation, and those types of things that actually hurt small businesses rather than help, then it concerns more and more people, and people get less likely to incorporate in the state and develop more business and become entrepreneurs than the state is hoping for, of course.
Sure, and you add that to the potential of having some kind of a fine set against you if you don't have health insurance. I'm not getting political, but I'm just adding up the problems here. That if you're a business and now you have X amount of dollars that you have to pay because you're forced to with health insurance, and on top of that, there's a sales tax that you didn't have to pay before, I can see the writing on the wall, and just these two factors alone will cause businesses to go out of business or to leave the states where they're incorporated in.
Right, and especially as businesses are having a very difficult time surviving, it seems like, small businesses like Amazon-type referral businesses, smaller advertising businesses that would refer business to Amazon or sell small products, those are the perfect example of businesses that were just barely surviving, let alone now to be hit with this potential sales tax. And then, of course, as they take on employees, as they begin to grow, then you get hit with the requirement, as you mentioned, of having to pay for their health benefits and all of these other things. It just becomes something that almost is cost prohibitive. You either have to be tiny small, so small that you're barely thriving, or large enough to sustain such blows as large taxes. I mean, many people are commenting on the fact that it's not going to be a big deal to Amazon to have to pay these taxes. It's really the big deal to those that are somewhere in between, those businesses that are not so huge and not so small. It's those businesses that are actually collecting revenue and are going to have to pay a substantial amount of taxes because of these laws.
No, sure. There's ongoing and continuous expenses that a business has. And based on that foundation where they make their decisions from and that physical structure that they have, that they know that at the end of the day that they have to bring in so much money to be able to cover the expenses and whatever profits left over. You start kicking up the expenses, it's got to come from somewhere. Where does it come from? It comes from the customer base that now has to spend more money for the same product. Otherwise, that business can't be in business. Then they go up and they go into competition against somebody else from another state that doesn't have the restrictions that, say, California or those few other states you talked about have. Boy, I can see a mess.
Absolutely. And you add to that the fact that then in California you're having to hire employees to manage your growth potentially, and then the employees are, you're at that point required to pay all of the health insurance benefits and those types of things, and then it just does, it does become cost prohibitive. Being a business in California, I feel it, a business owner, I feel it myself, and then, you know, when we talk to small businesses every day and we actually hear from them, I'm evaluating which state to incorporate in. That's one of the biggest questions we get asked when we're starting helping small businesses incorporate and form LLCs. And they're thinking, I should just form out of state, Nevada or Delaware, where it's far more tax-friendly states and where there's a lot less income taxes, et cetera. They decide to move out of state or at least incorporate out of state and run their businesses out of other jurisdictions.
Oh, sure. Nevada corporations for years have been less expensive than other places. But the point of contention also is you talk corporation, we'll talk your language for a moment. It's the type of corporation that these people are going to get into. Is it going to be, you know, a full-blown C-Corp, an LLC, whatever the case may be? And I think a lot of businesses hear the word incorporation and really don't know which one of those incorporations is the best for their business in particular.
Sure. We find that people who are really small businesses who were originally maybe a partnership or sole proprietor often end up nowadays forming LLCs. It used to be that LLCs were sort of nouveau, and now it's a lot more common to form an LLC because you're taxed as a partnership in that scenario and not as a corporation, so you don't have that double taxation. And the ongoing management requirements for an LLC are actually a bit simpler. You don't have to have your meetings and minutes and maintain your documents in the same way. So we find that especially smaller businesses who don't anticipate taking on a large number of investors, for example, end up forming as LLCs. People who are anticipating having investment capital, they often start out as S corporations, also taxed as partnerships. And then sometimes the interesting part is they convert to a C corporation down the road, but they start out as either an S corporation or an LLC, both of which are taxed as a partnership. Then they're familiar with the taxation process because it's very much how you were taxed if you were just a sole proprietor. But you do, of course, then have the added benefits of, you know, protection from your personal assets and tax savings that are additional when you are an incorporated entity.
Oh, sure. And then the LLC, the operative word there is limited liability. It's limited to that particular business that you're in, and they can't go any farther than that. The S Corp, I think, now stop me if I'm wrong, but that was four people or less, right?
The S corporation tends to be a smaller type of entity. It's actually now been up to, in most jurisdictions, up to 100 owners. But it can be owners. It has to be limited to certain types of owners. So up to 100 owners/investors, and at that point, you can no longer claim S corporation status.
Okay. Now, I'm going to become a listener. Now, I've listened to this conversation. What is it that you want me to get out of that conversation? What is it that you want me to hear that's going to affect my life, and how can you help me with it?
Sure. So I think that the important thing is small businesses are having a tough time in this economy, and think changes are being made that sometimes aren't to the benefit of small businesses. They are needing to thrive and have advantages that other larger businesses have already in place. And so I'm an advocate for small businesses, and I think one of the most important things small businesses need to do is incorporate to protect their personal assets. They need to get an LLC or a corporation, whichever the relevant choice may be in their particular circumstance based on the tax laws in their jurisdiction. But I think the underlying topic here about the sales tax collection is really just one facet of the frustrations and difficulties that small businesses face when they are coming to get started and begin growing their business. It's complicated out there. It's not easy for a small business owner, an entrepreneur. They're typically passionate about their product or service, but when it comes to the laws, the sales tax laws and collection, new legislation, whether it's incorporating your business or figuring out how to pay your taxes, those are the two most complicated things that we hear when we work with small businesses. And so I think having a business like ours, for example, who can help give you information on what are the requirements for an LLC or a corporation, how many people can you have in each, and how we kind of create a bigger picture. How can we help you look at sales taxes? How can we introduce you to CPAs and accountants that can produce for you answers that you need? And I think we're just one resource in a whole huge slew of resources that are necessary as small businesses and entrepreneurs try to translate their business idea into a true, full-blown business.
Well, no question about it. And I believe for years and years and years now that when it really comes down to it, that you may have an idea of a business, some kind of a service, product, concept, whatever it is, cause. And because you have it and because you may be very good at it does not necessarily mean that you can have that adjunct, that expertise that has to, that ancillary expertise that has to go along with it. So you go out to the people who know what they're doing to be able to help you so you don't fall down in 6 months to a year. I'm all for that. Deborah Sweeney, let me ask you this. We're running out of time. Do you have a website we can find you at?
Yeah, we do. It's mycorporation.com, mycorporation.com. And we are happy to answer any business questions you have. And we have lots of customer service people who can kind of talk with you about business ideas and help small businesses just figure out kind of what's the next step and how can we help in that process.
By the way, it's been wonderful having you on, and I want to thank you so much for the time you're spending with us.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Take care. Good night.
Good night.
As they say in this biz, that's all there is. There isn't any more. We've shared a moment, and as the moment ends,
I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and that, my friends, is a wrap.
I've got a funny feeling we're parting out as friends. Your cheers and laughter will linger after they've torn down these dusty walls. If I had this to do again, and the evening.